It's the Burt Cohen Show. We're going to be talking about whistleblowers today as part of what we are as Americans. I believe it's extremely important to know the truth, what the truth is. And I believe we have Tom with us. Tom Devine, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Well, welcome to the Burt Cohen Show. Tom Devine is legal director of the Government Accountability Project, which you may or may not have heard of, but it's an extremely important tool for getting at the truth. And we in America kind of like the truth. Mr. Devine has assisted over 5,000 whistleblowers defending themselves against retaliation and making a difference, such as shuttering an accident-prone nuclear power plant. I guess more than one of those, too. And it's funny about accidents and nuclear power. Checkmating repeated industry ploys to deregulate government meat inspection. I think we kind of like clean, safe meat. And blocking the next generation of the bloated and porous so-called Star Wars missile defense craziness. He has been a leader in the campaigns to pass or defend 20 major national and international whistleblower laws, including every one enacted here in America over the last two decades. He has authored and co-authored numerous books, including Courage Without Martyrdom and his latest, The Corporate Whistleblower's Survival Guide, a handbook for committing the truth. And he's written many law review articles, newspaper op-eds, and is a frequent expert commentator on television and radio talk shows, such as this, The Burt Cohen Show. Well, Tom, thanks for being with us. There's a law on the books, the Whistleblower Protection Act. It's rather ironic that now, in 2011, that law is seen as the chief deterrent for would-be whistleblowers. Why has it been called ineffectual? That wasn't the intent of the law now, was it?
When the law was passed unanimously and actually strengthened after President Reagan pocket vetoed its first enactment, it was the strongest free speech law in history on paper. The Achilles heel was that the employees didn't have normal due process options to enforce their rights. For example, they had to go to a real minor league, highly politicized administrative board instead of to act when on the rights when they were retaliated, instead of having access to court and jury trials the way that's available for private sector whistleblowers. If they did want to appeal an administrative decision, they could only go to one court instead of having normal access to the appellate court system. And this one court was so stacked that it had about the same attitude towards whistleblowers as the FISA court does towards personal privacy. It didn't agree with it. The result has been just a complete disaster. To mix Greek metaphors, the law has become a Trojan horse for whistleblowers. A very, very efficient mechanism to finish off anyone who's naive enough to rely on their rights and spend years of beating their head against a legal wall and tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to hammer the final nail in their own professional coffin. It's ended up being the best reason that would-be whistleblowers would keep their mouths shut and look the other way. You know, and I want, I'm not just saying this with adjectives. This is, I mean, I wanted to be proud of this law. I spent 4 years of my life passing it. It's like my professional baby, and my baby grew up to be Frankenstein. It's no way around the facts. At the one court which whistleblowers have access to, since Congress unanimously strengthened the law in 1994, the track record has been 3 wins and 219 defeats for whistleblowers in decisions on the merits. They don't have a fighting chance.
Wow. We are talking with Tom Devine, legal director of the Government Accountability Project, and maybe it'd be good here to talk about what is the Government Accountability Project, what is its purpose, and how would you define a whistleblower? What is a whistleblower?
Those are very well-taken questions. Since we're a transparency organization, all your whistleblowers have the right to know, who are these guys? We're a non-profit, nonpartisan public interest organization, basically a law firm, whose mission is supporting whistleblowers. We do it by defending them against retaliation, by investigating their charges, helping them to make a difference, by working all the time to get stronger free speech laws in this area, and by sharing our lessons learned, by such as writing books or appearing on shows like the Burt Cohen Program. And the people who are the point of all this work, whistleblowers, are quite a group. These are the people who keep our society from being stagnant, whether we love them or hate them. They're sort of the pioneers for change throughout history. And they're also, you know, like truth and beauty. Whistleblowing is all in the eyes of the beholder. depending on my own behavior, if you blow the whistle, you might be my savior or you might be my worst enemy. So the way we define the term, the people that we help, are employees who exercise free speech rights to challenge abuses of power that betray the public trust. That's the people we're committed to at GAP.
Wow, and I can think throughout American history, largely through the 20th century, of the incredible importance of whistleblowers on keeping us safe and keeping people literally from dying. I think about Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. I guess he was kind of a whistleblower. He saw what was going on in those meat packing factories and how incredibly unsanitary they were, and as a result really changed government a lot and you know, made their regulations for what could be put into the food that Americans eat. And I'm sure there were those who felt like this is an unnecessary intrusion into private enterprise. I wonder if you could talk about a little bit of the notable whistleblowers in American history.
Well, I'd start out with the 400 meat inspectors who blocked the government from rolling back the reforms created by Upton Sinclair. Four times during the 1980s and 1990s, the government planned to replace government meat inspection with corporate honor systems, where the companies would inspect themselves but still get the government seal of approval. And they beat it back every time by exposing just the awful filth that companies try to make money off of. And my primer for that, Bert, was reading Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, to be defending his legacy. But there's many individuals who have made a real difference, too. I think one outstanding example is Dr. David Graham. He's an FDA scientist, and he blew the whistle on Vioxx, the super painkiller that turned out to be a killer painkiller. Dr. Graham testified in the Senate that it had caused some 50,000 unnecessary fatal heart attacks for Americans, mostly elderly Americans, which is, you know, around as many people as Americans has died in the Vietnam War. Only this was from a drug which our government had officially decreed was safe. They did it because the drug industry was making about $1 billion in profits off of this drug every year. And within 2 weeks of Dr. Graham's testimony, the Merck Corporation, which manufactured it, had to withdraw Vioxx from the market because there was $400 billion in lawsuits from the victims' families. He made a real difference, and this is just one of about a dozen drugs like that that Dr. Graham has gotten removed from the market and are no longer threatening the lives of patients who rely on them, thanks to him sticking his neck out. Or there's a human rights example that just inspires me so much. It's as inspirational as it was hideous that we needed a whistleblower. The whistleblower is a customs agent named Kathy Harris from Atlanta Airport, and she blew the whistle because Customs Bureau was arbitrarily detaining foreign visitors, mostly attractive women, but detaining them without any evidence and accusing them of drug smuggling.
Oh,
and if they couldn't find anything in their luggage, they'd do body cavity searches. Not just a strip search, because that'd be the outside of the body. It's the inside of the body, too. You put your poke inside of any opening in a person's body. Well, if they couldn't find any drugs then, they would take these women to hospitals and subject them to laboratory tests for up to 4 days. And during that time, they couldn't contact a lawyer. They couldn't contact their families. It's like their bodies were property of the United States government.
Mm.
Kathy exposed this courageous black woman from Atlanta in the Customs Service. The government couldn't defend the actions, and 4 days was shrunk to 2 hours. The amount of time that we can detain a foreign visitor without giving them the normal rights of U.S. citizens who are suspects. This was just 5 years ago, Bert. It's not just the U.S. either. It's an honest auditor for the European Commission exposed Paul Van Buitenen's his name. He exposed that all the members of the European Commission were getting bribes on procurement, and that the ringleader for it was the president of the EC, Edith Cresson of France, and the bagman was her dentist. And he exposed this all. He's one lonely person committing the truth, and he prevailed. All the commissioners and President Cresson had to resign. Her dentist went to jail. He really made a difference. Whistleblowers, within 2 months of coming to Gap, had exposed that Paul Wolfowitz, the mastermind of the Iraq War, Mr. Big Shot, who came to the World Bank to clean up international corruption, was primarily qualified teaching how to get away with corruption. thanks to those whistleblowers, he had to resign within 2 months. It's David versus Goliath.
Right.
Isn't just a biblical story. It's modern day reality when employees have the truth in their slingshots. And probably the one that's to me the most gut wrenching example in my current docket is a gentleman who's going to be one of your guests the second half hour, man named Franz Geil. Franz can go into more of the details, but he successfully challenged bureaucratic passive aggression that was blocking for a year and a half delivery of mine-resistant vehicles that could save our troops' lives if they ran over a landmine in Iraq or Afghanistan. And because these hadn't been delivered, we had about a third of our combat casualties there, people who had died or injured or paralyzed for the rest of their lives. And it was because the government just wasn't delivering these vehicles, which we'd already paid for, which were ready to go. They did the same thing with non-lethal crowd dispersers. We had something called the Dazzler, which would break up crowds in Iraq and mobs without hurting them. It was like another version of a taser that was even less less dangerous. And we weren't delivering those either. So our troops would have to put shoot live ammunition into the crowds when they got out of control, and then they'd really hate us. France successfully challenged this, blew the whistle, exposed it, challenged it. The deliveries were made, and the unnecessary casualties and civilian deaths stopped, and the Marines never forgave him. And what they ended up doing was yanking his, suspending his security clearance, saying he's not trustworthy to serve in the Marine Corps after he saved literally thousands of people from being Marines from being killed or injured or paralyzed. And they said this on the basis that somebody put an unsecure flash disk in his computer one day, in his secure computer, and therefore must have been him. And he must have been planning to steal classified information from the government for God knows what reason. And you know, as we turned out, that they never found this flash disk. He didn't know anything about it. It could have been done while he was out at lunch or something. All sorts of people had access to his computer. But they never found the disk. We contacted the company with the serial number of this disk. They said, we never made any disk with those serial numbers. There is no such disk. But on the basis of this phantom flash disk, he's been on professional house arrest for the last year, assigned to his home without any duties. The man's a genius, and now they're going to starve him out, threatening to cut off his salary rather than do non-classified work. It's like anyone who exposes abuses of power is just putting like a professional X on their own chest, and unlike the private sector, where we've got gold standard rights against retaliation, government workers don't have a chance to defend themselves if they defend the taxpayers.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Tom Devine, legal director for the Government Accountability Project. And there was recently a meeting, some sort of a convocation, if you will, of whistleblowers. I wonder if you could tell us what the purpose of that was and if there's a difference now with President Obama in the White House, because he's talked about transparency. Are his words backed up by action? So I guess it's a two-part question there.
Well, we just finished last week having a National Washington Whistleblower Assembly, and one purpose of it is for solidarity and networking. There's a community of people who stick their necks out, and it can be very frightening and lonely, and they need to get together to give each other mutual support and reaffirm that they're not crazy for sticking their necks out the way their employers are insisting. And that's one purpose of it. Another purpose is to gather about 100 whistleblowers together to lobby Congress to get stronger free speech laws, to pass the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act that would give them a level playing field. And we've been working for 12 years to pass, and was unanimously passed by the House and Senate last Congress, and killed on a procedural act of enactment. It was killed procedurally by a secret hold in the Senate an hour before Congress adjourned last December. And so we're roaring back to get this law passed. We learned from doing a Find the Secret Killer campaign with National Public Radio, the hold was placed by senior Republican leadership in the Senate, and it was at the request of, as a professional courtesy, we were explained, of the incoming House leadership, Mr. Boehner and Mr. Cantor, who, for some reason, wanted to kill the whistleblower protection rights. And you know, this just really has everyone scratching their heads, because they campaigned on a mantra of ending the abuses, fraud, waste, abuse, unnecessary spending by big government, government bureaucracies. And here they are sabotaging rights for the workers on the front lines, who actually risk their careers for their campaign rhetoric. And these guys are secretly blocking from being able to defend themselves. So we come roaring back. And at that assembly was also a very enraged conservative constituency. What are these politicians doing? One of the things that we did at the assembly was to release a letter from 15 conservative organizations demanding that Congress finish passing this Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. And no secret holds or procedural tricks this time. It included the National Taxpayers Union, the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, the Americans for Tax Reform, Grover Nordquist Group, the Darth Vader of government spending. They all were lining up in solidarity with the whistleblowers, as well as the unions and the civil liberties organizations and the good government groups. The Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association released a letter saying that whistleblower protection is essential for homeland security. It means that we'll be prepared for the next attack instead of a bureaucracy that's asleep at the wheel, ignoring the warnings of its professionals. So that was another purpose of the conference,
sure.
to fight
build
for
political pressure,
passage
sure.
of this reform.
Good. And what about, Upton Sinclair obviously set the stage. He ran for governor of California, came pretty close, but he was stopped in, I believe it was 1934. A lot of the big corporations fought against him and put out a lot of lies against him and derailed his campaign. And right now we have kind of this new mantra a lot of the Tea Party, right, saying freedom, freedom, don't have any government interference in how the big corporations want to do business. There was actually New Hampshire's member of Congress actually came out in wanting to do away with the necessity of the inconvenience of meat inspection, for example. He truly did. And I wonder if this presents a new political problem for you, if the cry for freedom and that any government interference in the absolute, unrestrained free market is socialism.
I think that whistleblowers, when they defend playing it straight on the job, expose how essential and invaluable the government is for all sorts of scenarios that could be disastrous if no one was defending the taxpayers, whether it's protecting against contaminated meat or unsafe prescription drugs, or law enforcement, whether it's terrorists or domestic criminals. There's a lot of times you've got to have the cop on the beat, whether it's the consumer protection cop or the anti-crime cop. But whistleblowers don't set those policies. Their role is to see that we play it straight with the laws on the books. Whistleblowers will have common ground a lot of times with the Tea Party, who says that we're wasting our money with government regulation. But it's from a different angle. The Tea Party will say it's a waste of money to try and regulate, and the whistleblowers will say we're not engaging in honest regulation. We're just maintaining the appearance of keeping big business from exploiting the taxpayers in order to make illegal profits. The regulations are just kind of window dressing, and that their hands are being tied when they want to enforce the law the way the public needs and thinks we're being protected. So whistleblowers are about, they're not so much about setting policy, they're about playing it straight on the job. That's something that, as talking with my friends who are, activists from Ralph Nader's networks and mm-hmm. Common Cause and the Union of Concerned Scientists, and my friends from the Liberty Coalition and the National Taxpayers Union, that we've all got one thing in common. This is trans-ideological. It's beyond partisan. It's about being honest. The people who have power, being honest with the people who don't have it, so that we can make informed choices and have some sort of control of our lives, and really know what it is we're pushing for. Not just the political slogans of the Tea Party or the progressives, but what's the reality behind those party lines?
Interesting. And what is the reality behind President Obama when it comes to whistleblowers? He's talked about transparency. Are his words backed up by actions?
I think it's like a lot of things with the administration. He was speaking in good faith, and from my experience, he's been the strongest president in history for protecting whistleblowers. No one else has come close. He has, on the other hand, though, been the target of sort of a popular campaign that he's at war with whistleblowers. And both sides have a point. The point about being at war with whistleblowers is his administration is prosecuting leakers. That's been equated with a war on whistleblowers. To me, it's not quite the same thing, though. The people that have been prosecuted, with one exception, have been people just making indiscriminate leaks. And to me, a document dump that indiscriminately releases classified information and can expose innocent people to harm, like Dick Cheney did with Valerie Plame. And we thought he was, you know, a real jerk because it would expose all her secret sources to being assassinated. Well, I don't think that it's cool for people for the noblest of reasons to just do indiscriminate leaks of information that can end up having a lot of innocent casualties in the process. Sometimes there's information that would qualify as whistleblowing that's part of it, but I don't have so much of a gripe of him going after the mass leakers. There's one case of a very legitimate whistleblower whom our organization represented and championed, Tom Drake, who did everything right working within the system. And he was prosecuted during the Obama administration. It was started by the Bush administration. And as President Obama's White House lawyers told me when I was giving them all sorts of grief about this, what's going on here? How can you possibly allow this prosecution to continue? They said, we're not allowed as political appointees to just come in and cancel ongoing prosecutions that were brought by career staffs at the Justice Department. That would be properly attacked as political interference with prosecution. And even President Bush couldn't kill the tobacco litigation for 7 years. They said, really, we can't do much. But in the end, they did settle the case for just trivial penalties on it. So I think there's some, you know, valid concerns, but a lot of it's been cheap shots against the president in this war on whistleblowers. Things he's done to help have been very significant. He's appointed the strongest lineup in history of employee and free speech rights activists to head the agencies that implement the whistleblower laws. And that's when you find out if a politician is really serious. It's one thing to have these nice things on paper, but who you pick to turn the paper rights into reality is the litmus test, whether there's a genuine commitment. And this is almost like a dream team for whistleblowers that he's appointed for both government and corporate rights. He also has had Obama's law school roommate, a guy named Norm Eisen, was the White House Counsel for Ethics and personally adopted passage of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act as a priority. And he worked on the front lines with us throughout the last Congress to get the law to the point where only a last hour a secret hold could kill it. And the White House went to the mat and fought to get jury trial rights for the government whistleblowers when Congress was just going to give them more administrative hearings. And during our Washington Whistleblower Assembly, the White House came out with a statement of support for Congress to pass that law this year. And if Congress doesn't act, they're going to take executive action, such as an executive order, to implement those rights. Well, no president has ever done that for us before. I've been fighting for whistleblowers for 33 years, and the White House has never gone beyond sort of like symbolic endorsements on the surface while stabbing us in the back, you know, in the back rooms. And here's a president whose top aides are right in the front lines calling me after midnight last Congress to work out strategy for the next day and see if we can get this law passed. I think he's really tried. But like so many things with the current administration, he hasn't succeeded yet. I think there's been a good faith commitment, but the results aren't in.
Well, it's certainly always important to have public support. President Roosevelt said to A. Philip Randolph about ending discrimination, you know, I'm with you. I want to help you. Go out there and make me do it. So that's where public people being out on the streets making noise absolutely helps.
Well, I think it's up to us to demand that the politicians play it straight instead of using whistleblowers for their election campaigns and then abandoning them when it counts. And if we do that, the Republicans ought to be more enthusiastic about passing these rights than the Democrats. That these are the people who personify, you know, what Barry Goldwater's mantra, the rugged individualist fighting bureaucratic abuses of power. Where's the Republican Party for these people who live their slogans?
Interesting point. Well, Tom Devine, legal director of the Government Accountability Project. And if people want to look that up on the web, what's the best way to do it?
We're www.whistleblowersingular.org. And check it out. Get in touch with us. We need all the help we can get to get over the top this time.
And where we're coming from here in New Hampshire, some of the candidates do come through here and people can ask them questions. www.whistleblower.org, is it?
ORG, yes.
ORG. All right. Thank you very much, Tom Devine. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes talking with a genuine whistleblower. Thanks very much for being with us, Tom.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back. Truth, Derek and the Dominoes from 1972. We are about telling the truth, standing up to big threats. David and Goliath, hey, it's a real story. It wouldn't be in the Bible unless it connected with everybody in all time. Bert Cohen here. Our guest now is Franz Geil. Franz, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us today on relatively short notice. Franz Geil has served as a Marine for 22 years before he was hired by the Marine Corps as a science and technology advisor. As an advisor, Geil was requested by name by the commanding general to deploy in Iraq back in September 06, where he witnessed what he called gross mismanagement in the procurement of urgently requested tanks, basically, that can resist mines. Mine-resistant, what does MRAP stand for, Franz?
Mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, MRAP.
Aha, sounds kind of useful. Well, this allegation that you made was later validated during the course of a Department of Defense Inspector General audit. Well, tell us about what happened there and what motivated you to take some action about these tanks that could protect American lives.
Well, yeah, they have, with the armor, they're tank-like, I guess, in some respect, but they are trucks. They're used for transporting, most importantly, people. I think when I was invited over to Iraq to try and address some of the difficulties that they've been experiencing with the procurement folks, I already had an indication from my past experience with the procurement bureaucracy that there were some challenges, some conflicts. I call them conflicts of interest between the interests of the bureaucracy and the interests of the young men and women in the field.
Mm.
Now, for me, during the before going over there, that was all. It was more of a theoretical a supposition that yeah, there's got to be an impact in the field. But when I got over there into Iraq, I really did see that there was a real impact in terms of requests that had been delayed or denied for things that were then causing harm to the young Marines in the field, getting them killed, getting them injured, maimed, unnecessarily, because the solutions were out there. I don't take any credit for coming up with the solutions, but I do, you know, I'm just the messenger. These issues and frustrations were brought to me, to my attention while I was over there, serving as a science advisor,
mm-hmm.
Were brought to my attention by the Marines over there. And so we fixed a good number of the problems while I was still in the short period that I was in Iraq. But then I came back with the intention of making sure that that I served as a method of feedback to the Marine Corps, and then I was invited to brief the Department of Defense as well, so I could be a feedback mechanism, so that this wouldn't happen again in the future.
Where there,
when I came back is when my problems really started.
Well, first off, I want to make sure to get to that. Were there difficulties, roadblocks set up? You would think, you know, a lot of our guys and women are getting hurt, killed, losing limbs. Of course, we want to get them the best protective devices that are available. And they were indeed available. They did exist, but they weren't getting from point A to the people in the field. Was there a difficulty in working on the procurement process through the chain of command? And was it intentional roadblocks that were put up?
Well, as it turned out, they had been requested, for instance, these vehicles. But there's a longer history to this that's kind of frustrating to hear, too, is that the Marine Corps and the Army were well aware that the Humvee, that we're also well acquainted with,
right,
was literally a death trap. And I say that because that's quotations from a report. Both services knew that it was helplessly vulnerable because of its aluminum flat bottom. Actually, it actually enhances the blast.
Oh my.
Of a bomb. We knew this in 1994.
Whoa.
1994. 10 years before we even went into Iraq. And clearly neither service took action on that. Humvee remained, even for those 10 years, remained a part of the procurement, in the procurement pipeline. Obviously, big business interests involved.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Humvee is American-made. It's a huge product line. It's a lot of money involved. And so one of the things that bureaucracies don't like to do is they don't like to change course if it takes money from pet programs, favored programs around whose careers, civilians and military alike, have grown. That there's no motivation within a larger procurement bureaucracy to change course if it's not in the direct material interests of the folks who are making those decisions.
Right, free market.
So, we knew about the problem as far back as the mid 90s. Well, now we come up to the war. Well, obviously the Humvees took a beating from the beginning, and lots of kids got you know, hurt and killed.
Yeah.
Then we come up on 2005, and one of the commanders in Iraq, two years before I came over there, or a year and a half, said, okay, and enough is enough. We can't sustain these casualties anymore. This is just unconscionable.
Yeah.
And he wrote a formal request for MRAPs,
right.
the vehicle
that's protected.
We were talking about.
Yeah.
And so it's like any other bureaucracy. Okay, you write and sign a request, and it says this, and it says that, and it, you know, specifically requested MRAPs. It goes into the docket, right, just like anything else.
Right.
And it should get processed accordingly.
Yep.
Well, it was an urgent request.
Understandably.
And this was in 2005.
Yes.
It went in, and it was an urgent request. And they're supposed to be acted on very rapidly, within just a couple months, few months of their receipt. And everything is the bureaucracy is supposed to, when it's functioning well, bend over backwards, you know, throw all other projects to the winds, make sure that the warfighter's urgent request gets answered and fulfilled, so that we can stem these casualties.
That would seem obvious.
that request, as it turned out, again, I'm the messenger, as was reported to me, and I confirmed it later in some research in a case study, disappeared. And after much research, et cetera, while I was over there and after coming back, it turned out that it was very clear that the reason it disappeared is because it competed against these other pet programs.
Wow.
For money. It was a very expensive request. I mean,
yeah.
Back in 2005, the general in Iraq asked for, you know, well over $1 billion worth of these vehicles. And while that doesn't seem much, you know, to other services, it's a huge amount for the Marine Corps. It was probably the biggest request that ever came into the Marines on an urgent basis.
Mm-hmm.
And that money would have had to come from somewhere.
Right.
And it would have had to come from somewhere on very short notice because it was an urgent request. And the programs that it would have taken money from were heavily touted and championed by the civilians and folks in the bureaucracy down in Quantico, Virginia. And they included the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle, which has now been canceled. It was an amphibious vehicle.
No doubt expensive.
As well as the Humvee program, which was being heavily upgraded with armor, add-on armor, and armor from the factory, which is a particular model, M1114. All of these things, huge money behind them, huge contracts for both the Army and the Marine Corps, and the Marine Corps often likes to buy in to Army contracts because the Army contracts are usually much larger, and of course there's a cost savings.
Sure.
The unit price goes down the larger the number that's requested. So there was a real business case to go with Humvees and to continue on with these programs like the EFV. Because it was in the interests of the support establishment to do so.
Interesting. Well, what
didn't answer the mail for the Marines though, and the Marines paid heavily for it in Iraq because it caused that particular disappearance of that request caused a 19-month delay and at the height of the insurgency in Iraq. And that's tragic.
Wow, that really is. Well, were you considered a hero by the Marines, I would think? I mean, here you were busting your tail to try to save theirs. What did the Marines... did they support you and go all out in helping you? And what happened when you came back to these United States?
Well, just let me, I'm going to put this on a little bit louder so I can hear you a little bit better. Hold on.
Okay. We are talking with Franz Geil, who served as a Marine for 22 years.
Go ahead. Can you hear me?
Oh, quite well, yes.
Okay, well, when I got back to the United States, my first approach was to want to go through the proper channels. And I was invited by an office in the Office of the Secretary of Defense called the Director of Defense Research and Engineering, DDR&E. And the gentleman, the assistant undersecretary who ran that office, or he's actually a director, DDR&E, wanted to hear our observations, my observations in particular. I was invited by name, but certainly the commanders with me, who were also willing to come and brief him on the challenges with urgent procurement. And so this was initially approved by the general who I worked for in the Pentagon. It's initially approved under one condition, that the presentation that I put together would have to be previewed by all of the support establishment offices that were impacted. In other words, if I was going to say express concern about some office down in Quantico or somewhere else, that I should at least give them a heads up on what I'm going to say.
Sounds
fair
reasonable.
Enough.
Okay.
And so I did so. I worked with another gentleman in an active duty Marine in California who was my boss over in Iraq. We created this presentation together, and once it was done, sent it out to the impacted parties. Within hours of sending it out, I was approached by my supervisors and told that my presentation was canceled, that I would be prohibited from approaching DDR&E with this presentation. I was even directed to go out to the parties I sent it to, as crazy as this sounds, and have them delete it. I mean, in an electronic age, what value that direction had, I have no idea, but that's what I was asked to do. I should delete it. Because in the presentation, I associated delays in the bureaucracy with casualties in the field.
Understandably.
And that was just unthinkable that I should say something like that.
Ah. Okay, that sounds like that line from the movie. You can't handle the truth.
Yeah, well, a little bit. Now, and that was accompanied with my first bad paper, too. I mean, it was like on the following day, I was called in and given this very severe counseling from my supervisor and the acting division head representing the general, and I was to sign this. I signed this counseling, this formal counseling that I'd received it for going outside of the chain of command without prior permission and approval from my own supervisors, and I had done this on a different occasion. On a similar situation, so it was kind of a double whammy that they would get me on two of the issues that I'd gone outside the chain of command on,
mm-hmm.
And I was punished for it. And
was there an investigation? And did your I read something about your security clearance being suspended? Now that seems
that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning of
okay.
of my trials. That was just the first mild censure that started from there. But that's because I continued to speak up. I knew that if this issue, you know, forget about my situation, my personal situation, if this issue didn't get addressed at a very high level, whether it was in the Department of Defense, outside of the Marine Corps, I have to add, because I knew that the problems that I mentioned before, the conflicts of interest that people in the support establishment sometimes have in these programs, it had to come from outside of the Marine Corps, above the Marine Corps. And if I couldn't go to the Department of Defense, I had to go to somebody.
Of course.
Because the problem will not get resolved, and the same people and culture will exhibit the same practices in the future. And on similar situations, if they're not critiqued now and corrected now, it will happen again in the future. And again, folks will be unnecessarily hurt as a result.
Wow.
And so I wasn't going to sit around and let that happen. At about the same time that I was punished that very first time, an article emerged in, I want to say it was Inside the Pentagon, that made a statement that quoted the Commandant of the Marine Corps as stating that the first request for MRAPs had not been issued from the field until 2006. And, of course, I knew that to be untrue because, you know, I knew it had been already in 2005.
Right.
And so I said, that can't be right. That the commandant wouldn't go on record. I think it was a letter to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He wouldn't do that. The commandants tell the truth. I mean, that's just not a truthful statement. Hmm. So the commandant would never say something like that, that he believed was that if he knew it was untrue. I said, but the people that brief him will tell him something that's not true. That's usually how it happens.
Sure.
The generals are good guys.
Yep.
They are wonderful guys. They wouldn't be Marine Corps generals if they weren't.
And they want to protect their troops from danger, I would.
They want the best for their Marines.
Yes.
But they are, the word general means generalist. And they depend absolutely on the experts, the subject matter experts,
uh-huh,
who do the day-to-day business below them, to give them truthful information.
Mm.
And that was obvious to me that the commandant had been given untruthful information by his subordinates.
Sure.
And so I realized this problem was big. And so I saw this then in the press. I had the behavior towards me confirmed, and then I saw this in the press. And exact sequence of events, but I was contacted by Senator Biden's office. First, I went back to the writer of that particular article. I asked him to correct it. I think he wasn't available, so I actually went to another journalist and asked her to quickly publish the fact that this just wasn't correct. And I gave her the information on the need that had been requested. Soon, I got a call from Senator Biden's office, and I was asked whether I would go on the record with USA Today. And I said, yes, I would speak to a reporter. And it was at about that point. And then I was also contacted by the Jim Lehrer NewsHour. And I did I went ahead on the record with them. That's when things quickly escalated.
Uh-oh.
Because I knew that if these things were to stand, untruthful comments, whether to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or to the Congress or to the public, the bureaucracy will never correct itself, and they will get away with this. And the Marines will suffer for it in the field. So I was determined to do something about it. And yeah, I knew it was going to be painful because I'm a Marine, and we're a family,
right?
And there's big consequences for embarrassing the family, and I know that, you know. And so I went in clear-eyed. It's not like I was like shocked with the response that I've gotten from the Marine Corps. It's not that I'm not going to fight back. Of course I'm going to fight. You know, I'm Marine. That's what I'm trained for. That's what we do.
Uh-huh.
And the Marines know that too, right? Not just gonna roll over, but at the same time, I'm not surprised at how the institution reacted. Not that I'm happy about it.
Right. Well, we're coming up to the end of the hour. Unfortunately, you have so much to say, Franz Geil. What can you tell us about the Government Accountability Project? Is you've been in touch with them? I take it, and is there reason for hope that what you did in trying to, you know, save some lives and tell the inconvenient truths, that the process is starting to improve? How did they interact with you on this?
Well, GAP's been wonderful. They've been supporting me throughout. If it wasn't for GAP, I wouldn't be here today in 2011 to tell this story. They are working with the Office of Special Counsel, or have been in the, over the years. We'll see new leadership in OSC. I'm very hopeful that something can be done. But there are no guarantees.
Right.
Right now, the Marines have me proposing to stop my pay within less than within a couple weeks here, and finally put an end to me. So we'll see if anything can happen in the meantime to prevent that. There are no guarantees that this will change in the future. And no, there are, at this point, I give no confidence to that someone like me would be any better protected in the future for something like I did.
Wow. Interesting stuff. Well, I don't know how people might be able to read more about your very interesting story. We could spend another hour or so just talking about this, but I don't know if there's any place on the internet that you can direct people to.
There's been several articles. The most recent one, which is a really, really good one, tells a very fair story, shows all the warts on me and all the issues I brought up, which I think is the way a story should be told. James Verini of the Washington Monthly.
Uh-huh. All right. So people can look at that as well. Well, thank you very much for being with us and being the David against Goliath. You know, people always appreciate that. There's the whole Aaron Brockovich thing, and it's a heck of an American tradition.
Yeah, we do what we got to do.
All right. Thank you very much, Franz Geil of the Marine Corps. Thanks for all your service. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. And Bert at Bert Cohen here, if you want to get in touch with me in the future. It's about telling the truth.